Hello, and welcome to the Hammock Historian Podcast. My name is Jeff, and I will be your host. This is our inaugural episode, and I am glad you guys could join us today. We're going to take a little bit of time and talk about the history of Cuba, the number of revolutions they've experienced throughout their history, as well as an economic product that becomes and remains a driving force throughout Cuba, sugar. But before we get to that, I do want to thank you all for listening in to our very first episode. I have started this podcast as essentially a little way to get some of those historical thoughts in my mind out to everybody. As far as qualifications, I do have a master's degree and have spent a fair bit of time researching agricultural history and the economics behind it. So I hope to kind of bring that expertise, or at least basic knowledge, to the podcast. I hope it's not too boring and that you guys enjoy. So we'll go ahead and get started. As we start our podcast today, we will be starting with a little bit of a drink to go along with our discussion. Our theme drink this week is actually the Cuba Libre, a little bit of a Havana classic. The origins of this drink begin around the end of the Spanish-American War, beginning of the 20th century. The origin story told all over the place generally begins the same. An American captain walks into a bar in the middle of old Havana, comes up, orders himself a rum and coke over ice with a twist of lime. The captain, having his drink, turns back to the bar, looks at its patrons, and begins toasting, "Por Cuba Libre," supposedly earning the drink its name. The captain, sometimes a member of Roosevelt's Rough Riders, likely doesn't exist. In fact, most sources list him as Captain John Doe of the American Army. For those not familiar, John Doe being a term to describe people with no identification. But the captain alone is not the only reason to doubt these supposed origin stories for the Cuba Libre. In fact, there are a number of issues with the story, including the fact that Coca-Cola isn't established until the late 1880s, and is not even then immediately bottled and shipped or widely available across the world. With the first major bottling occurring in 1899, it's extremely unlikely that Coke was available in bars in Havana at the turn of the century. And while smugglers are willing to bring almost anything into the island as long as there's a profit to be had, it is unlikely that they would have had bottled Coca-Cola to bring into those American soldiers. In fact, bottled Coca-Cola is not available widely in the U.S. until after the 1920s, when they begin to move away from soda fountains and the soda jerkers. Despite the drink's origins being shrouded in mystery, most believe the drink name originates with the battle cry of both Spanish and American soldiers during the Spanish and American War, the end of which resulted in heavy American influences on the island, including the importation of many goods from the United States. And it seems all too plausible that a battle cry amongst soldiers could quickly become a toast among friends, and the newly imported goods, such as Coca-Cola, paired well with the Cuban rum. The drink in its basic form has become commonplace the world over. But the name Cuba Libre has had a number of different connotations over the years. From the early days of revolutionary fervor after the end of the Spanish-American War, and during the 1920s, its popularity skyrockets during Prohibition, when the island became a haven for all of the drinkers and tourists of the Americas. The ideals behind the Cuba Libre stand strong, even though the freedom they were after was less colonial repression and more prohibition. The drink never seems to lose its popularity, and even with the rise of Fidel Castro in the 1950s, the Cuba Libre experiences a golden age, popular in bars not only in Cuba, but in the U.S., and after the revolution, in communist countries such as the Soviet Union, and even into China. But for now, we're going to get our drink mixed up. So if you're at home, get ready to get some stuff together and make yourself a drink. And if you're on the road, remember, don't drink and drive. Wait till you get home, have one this evening, and take a little time to reflect on the cool history you've learned today. So to start, take a highball glass, pour in some ice. From there, you can take 1.5 ounces of your favorite rum. Today, I'm actually using Bacardi, little clear rum from Puerto Rico. A little Cuba-esque since we're here in the United States. Next, we're going to add what makes this a Cuba Libre and not a rum and coke. I have just under a third of a shot, it's like 0.25 ounces of lime juice. For everyone at home, that does just leave our final ingredient, that classic in a red can, Coca-Cola. This is the part where if you'd like to impress your friends, we can cut up a little wedge of lime, put that right there on the edge of the glass. And a little stir, and you should be good to go. And that is your Cuba Libre. I hope you guys enjoy. While this drink has its origins in the Spanish-American War, the history of sugar in Cuba goes back much, much further. In fact, the origins of sugar date back to the 1520s when the Spanish introduced it to the Caribbean. In the early years, Cuba remained rather diverse, producing cattle, tobacco, sugar, and a number of other different crops on the island. Two events would propel Cuban sugar to the forefront of their economy. First, the British capture of Havana in 1762 during the Seven Years' War would lead to a huge increase in slaves imported to the island of Cuba. This increased number of slaves allowed the sugar planters to grow larger and larger fields, while retaining the low labor costs required to make sugar profitable. The second major factor was far more influential. The collapse of Haiti in 1791 from slave revolts and the burning of sugar plantations all over the island, Cuba remains as the only viable producer of sugar in the Caribbean that can replace the massive amounts of sugar produced on the island of Haiti. With an increasing price of sugar and free range on the market, Cuban sugar producers would expand and grow and grow. This expansion leads Cuba to become one of the largest sugar producers on the global market. At the beginning of the 1800s, Cuban sugar producers are growing all over the island, but the largest and most powerful mills remain centered around Havana on the western side of the island. In fact, Cuban sugar production would increase from 14,000 tons in 1790 to 34,000 tons by 1805, and production on the island would only go up from there. In 1818, the Spanish would have a royal decree opening Cuba to foreign markets, including the United States. Investment on the island would skyrocket, and U.S. investors begin to purchase large mills and holdings. Sugar plays a vital role in the growth and development of Cuba, especially economically. But the political driving forces are revolutions. There are three major ones that need a little extra attention leading up to the Spanish-American War and U.S. involvement in Cuba. And while I would love to just have an in-depth discussion of all the revolutionary movements throughout Cuba's history, I'm really trying to keep this podcast to about an hour, so it just doesn't seem doable for the moment. Maybe something we revisit. But for today, we'll just stick to the big three. The first being the 10 Years' War, sometimes referred to in Cuba as the Great War or the War of 68. This conflict occurred 1868 to 1878. Globally, this is the period in history where slavery is really starting to see a large decline, and many countries, including the United States, are starting to move towards emancipation of the slaves. The Civil War in the United States being probably the most well-known example. But Cuba does have its growing pains, and slavery and the emancipation of the slaves would remain a critical issue throughout the 10 Years' War. As is common in Cuba, sugar production and planters would be at the heart of the revolution. Rebels led by a Cuban-born planter, Carlos Manuel de Céspedes, would also push for tariff reforms and Cuban representation in the Spanish Parliament. The Criollos want to receive judicial equality to the Spaniards on the island, Criollos being citizens of Spanish descent but born on the island, had for years been limited in many of their rights. Cuban Criollos made up a large number of the planters on the island of Cuba, and many believed one of the rights infringed upon by the Spanish was who and how much could be traded from the island, especially the growing industrial power to the north, the United States. De Céspedes would begin his revolutionary movement by freeing the slaves on his plantation and asking them to join in his fight against the Spanish. Desesperes, on the eastern side of Cuba, well known for its insurrections and rebelliousness, would issue his October 10th manifesto, thus beginning his fight against the Spanish. The provinces in eastern Cuba, Oriente, Camagüey, Las Villas, would quickly rally behind Desesperes, but the western side of the island, Havana, all the flatlands where sugar was grown, remained in the hands of the Spanish. Loyalist to the crown, many of the Cubans on the western side of the island would seek some sort of peace negotiation, looking for a comfortable medium between the two options of revolution and complete obedience. Growing sugar in the western provinces of Cuba remained highly lucrative. Growers in western Cuba had the benefits of large ports like Havana, as well as a growing rail network that allowed them to move sugar far more efficiently. Production in eastern Cuba would lag behind. The Spanish began to increase troops on the island, and by 1869 they had begun a policy of concentrating the citizenry into towns and designated cities. Anyone found outside of these designated areas is to be executed, the only exemption being women and children, who would then be escorted to the closest town or camp, likely to receive punishment at the discretion of the camp officers. Many of the camps are poor in quality, unkempt, dirty, poorly supplied, and many historians consider these to be the onset of concentration camps as we tend to think of them today. Guerrilla warfare would continue in eastern Cuba until the deaths of Cespedes in 1874 and Agramonte in 1873. The revolutionary movement really begins to fade. The living revolutionaries, Maximo Gomez, Claxito Garcia, would all become revolutionaries in the wars to come. But the 10 Years' War would come to its conclusion without a whole lot of resolution, the Spanish government having been distracted by their own civil war from 1872 to 76, finally begins to crack down on the Cuban. The crackdown included sending large numbers of troops to the island, and in 1877, Estrada Palma is captured and the Cuban Assembly, the revolutionary government, is dissolved shortly after in 1878. What follows is a provisional government set up by the Spanish in a relatively quiet 17 years of peace. And it's during this peace that the Spanish would begin the manumission of slaves on the island of Cuba. From 1880 to 1886, there would be a slow process of freeing the slaves and including them into the Cuban society. The primary method was a slow, exploitive process of indentured servitude, primarily designed to entice slaves into spending all of their money on rum, a cheap alcoholic beverage made from the byproducts of sugarcane processing. In fact, throughout the Caribbean's history, many sugar producers, not only the Spanish, but French and British included, would use rum produced from the skimmings of sugarcane production to pay laborers or reward slaves for high production. The second well-known revolution in Cuba actually occurs just after the end of the 10 Years' War. This second conflict, known as the Little War or La Guerra Chiquita, is led by Claxito García, who would issue his manifesto against Spanish rule in Cuba in 1878, shortly after the end of the 10 Years' War. In fact, Claxito had refused to sign the Treaty of Zanjan, which was the treaty that ended the 10 Years' War in Cuba. With few allies and a shortage of weapons, the exhausted population of Cuba would not support Claxito. In fact, he was quickly defeated by the Spanish. While the war is short and not much occurs, it does continue to heat the growing resentment of Cubans towards the Spanish. It's this growing resentment that would lead to the Cuban War of Independence in 1895 that pushes and finally leads to the end of Spanish rule in the Caribbean. There is another revolutionary who gained experience during this time, but he would flee to Florida in 1881. This is where José Marte would begin to gain the support of people in Tampa's Ybor City as well as Miami and the Keys, in order to support his goal of free Cuba. And while he sought U.S. help, he also pushed against the U.S. annexation of Cuba. In March of 1895, Marty would present the Manifesto of Monte Cristi, which would outline the policy for Cuba's War of Independence. He would call for the preservation of private property on the island, fair treatment for any Spaniards who wished to remain, and maintained the primary goal was to bring new economic life to the island of Cuba. The eastern side of the island, a revolutionary hotbed as ever, provided José Marte and his revolutionaries invaluable support. But central Cuba suffered from a number of coordination issues, slowing progress and preventing many things from happening. Worst of all, movements in the province of Havana would be discovered before they were ever able to make any moves, thus complicating the resistance movements. The end of the 10 Years' War had resulted in the Spanish enforcing a ban on privately owned weapons, rebels needing to be able to equip themselves faster than any weapons or tools could be imported and smuggled in from overseas. The rebels began to rely heavily on guerrilla tactics, hit and run, showing up, popping out of nowhere, fleeing into the jungles of the eastern Cuba. It's during this time that we see widespread use of the machete, a tool normally used for harvesting sugarcane, now being used as a tool to help free the island. Marty himself would be killed shortly after landing on the island of Cuba in May of 1895. But many others, including Máximo Gómez and Antonio Maceo, would continue to fight on. On the eastern side of the island, the rebels would see a number of rapid successes, advancing them quickly towards the middle of the island. The Spanish, seeking to control all of the rebels on the eastern side of Cuba, would place General Weyler in charge of concentrating all of the citizens within a number of camps and cities once again. It's estimated that nearly 10% of the population would die due to being moved or the inhumane conditions of the camps. Spanish control of the island would eventually be reduced to the towns that they were controlling. All land outside of the city gates tended to be in the control of the rebels. Madrid would have a drastic turnaround and decide to change policies towards Cuba. They would replace General Weyler and also draw up constitutional governments for both Cuba and Puerto Rico. But with half the country out of control and the other up in arms, Madrid and their puppet government would not see much success. Following a series of riots in Havana in 1898, the United States would send the USS Maine to Havana Harbor in order to protect U.S. interests on the island. After less than a month in port, February 15, 1898, the Maine was rocked by an explosion, killing nearly 260 members of crew on the ship. With the rampant yellow journalism of the area, it was only a matter of time before the battle cry of "Remember the Maine, to hell with Spain" would become commonplace across the United States. And it's with that battle cry that we see the beginning of American involvement in Cuba, and the beginnings of the Spanish-American War. Before the sinking of the Maine, Americans had watched from afar as the small island, just 90 miles off the coast, attempted to throw off the shackles of colonialism, much as the Americans had done in 1776. But with the yellow journalism and the continued publication of atrocities in Cuba, as well as the sinking of the Maine, it was inevitable that the United States would become involved in the conflict. In April of 1898, the United States Congress would declare war on the Spanish. The declaration of war demanded Spanish withdrawal and authorized the president to use as much military force as he thought necessary to end the Civil War and the threat to U.S. interests on the island. This would also include the Teller Amendment, a special addendum stipulating that Cuba should by right and is both free and independent. While this amendment was pushed through at the last minute and prevented the United States from annexing the island of Cuba, it made no mention of Puerto Rico, Guam, or the Philippines, and other Spanish holdings that would come under the U.S. sphere of influence with the end of the Spanish-American War. Initially, the people of Cuba were thrilled at the prospect of help from the Americans, especially with the Teller Amendment assuring them that there was no intention to seize Cuba and bring it into the collection of states. But it's not long before the Cubans would begin to see the tidal wave that is American intervention. American troops would work their ways towards Santiago and begin to surround the city, while the U.S. fleets would begin making quick work of the Spanish Caribbean squadrons. But by July, after the end of a long siege, the Spanish would surrender to the United States. And it's with the end of the Spanish-American War that we see the birth of the Cuban Republic. The Republican period in Cuba has a number of issues, including new parties being formed, groups being overthrown, groups splitting, but it's most commonly split into two distinct eras, the first 30 years and the second. The first 30 years of the Republic, dating roughly from 1902, when Cuba gains its independence from being a protectorate under U.S. control, all the way until you get to the 1933 rebellion, where Batista and the Sergeant's revolutions would overthrow Cespedes and install a new government. This period in Cuban history is relatively stable, a large amount of American influence, new tourists coming in, growing industries from agriculture all the way to businesses. You would also see the beginnings of widespread corruption throughout the government, as well as mafiosos showing up on the island to run their hotels and casinos, take care of all those American tourists fleeing prohibition looking for a drink. But with the economic crash in 1929, not only did the tourism dry up, but the price of sugar would drop incredibly low, damaging the Cuban economy further and further. As the unrest grew, blame was placed on then-President Gerardo Machado. The 1930s would see a growing number of uprisings among sugar workers, as well as a general strike that would force Machado to flee into exile in August of 1933. Shortly after, in September of 1933, Fulgencio Batista would lead the Sergeant's Revolution and overthrow the government, installing a 5-member committee that was chosen to lead the new government. The Sergeant's Revolution is what leads us into the second period of the Cuban Republic, the years of Batista. Either in charge himself or the mastermind behind his puppets running the government, Batista would be the main figure throughout Cuban politics for the next 25-year period. One of the biggest issues faced by Cubans in the 1930s, following the economic crash of 1929, is what to do about the price of sugar. It dropped to incredibly low prices, and it seemed like the only way to increase it was to limit production. Unfortunately for Cuba, most other producers were not willing to reduce production, and in fact pushed for increased production, with new equipment, better facilities, and much larger fields growing sugarcane, sugar beets, and a number of other products. While Batista was not the first to place limitations or restrictions on the amount of sugar produced in Cuba, he would continue them throughout his time in power. One of the largest motivations for the Cuban government to do these harmful policies was actually to protect small Cuban sugar farmers. Many in the government believed that if sugar prices continued to decline, it would be those small farmers that suffered worse, would not be able to continue operating their mills, and would be bought out and run by larger American conglomerates. But even famed economists like John Maynard Keynes did not think that this was a sensible decision for Cuba in the long run. Reduction of sugar production would really only lead to other competitors stepping into the market. This was proved true as Cuba reduced sugar production, and other places like Java, Hawaii, and other tropical locales would increase sugar production exponentially. One man who would stand in opposition to these policies was Julio Lobo, the sugar king of Havana, one of the largest sugar producers and sellers in the Cuban market, and thus the world. Born on October 30, 1898, Julio Lobo y Oliveira was born to a Venezuelan banker who would immigrate to Cuba at the turn of the century. Looking for new economic opportunities, Lobo's father would bring him and his siblings with him to the island of Cuba, and Lobo would begin to proceed down the path, leading him to becoming the Sugar King of Havana. At his peak, Lobo would be worth nearly $200 million, control 14 sugar mills on the island of Cuba, and control almost half of Cuban sugar sales to the United States, half of Puerto Rican sales, and almost 60% of sales coming from the Philippines as well. Lobo would attend college, where he would specialize in sugar production, learning the most modern methods and techniques, all of the newest equipment and facilities that would be needed to produce sugar at a higher quality and faster. rate than the old-fashioned sugar mills that were run by small Cuban producers. Lobo would return to Cuba just in time to miss the famous Dance of the Millions, where Cuban sugar prices would skyrocket, millionaires made overnight, and then many more become poor, even faster than they had gained the riches in the first place. During the Dance of the Millions, wartime restrictions would have limited the price of sugar at 5.5 cents per pound. But with the end of the war, restrictions were lifted and the price of sugar would skyrocket. By February of 1920, it's selling at almost 9 cents per pound. By April, 18 cents per pound. And by May, it would peak at 20.5 cents per pound. Speculation in the sugar market becomes rampant. Prices are exaggerated. Loans are given based on sugar futures that may or may not exist, with incredibly high interest rates attached. But by 1920, the European sugar beet fields are going back into production, and the price of sugar would begin to plummet. By August in 1920, the price is down to 11 cents per pound, September, 8 cents per pound, and by the end of December, the price would bottom out, reaching a low of just over 3.5 cents per pound. The people in Cuba would begin to panic. Their entire economy, based primarily on sugar, was now taking an extreme hit. Bankers, sugar planters, mill operators would all begin to suffer. In fact, after the Dance of the Millions and the collapse of the sugar price, it's estimated that there are roughly $80 million in outstanding loans on the island of Cuba alone. But Lobo, too young to have gotten in and made a whole lot of money on the Dance of the Millions, Lobo instead applies this lesson to his future dealings in Cuban sugar. Unfortunately, other sugar producers on the island did not fare so well. In fact, before the Dance of the Millions, nearly 40% of mills on the island of Cuba were still owned by Cuban producers. Afterwards, only 20%. The reduction comes as a result of those massive loans made on U.S. banks. And after the Cuban producers are unable to pay their debts, U.S. banks and brokerages would take over almost a quarter of all mills on the island of Cuba in order to settle the massive debts. It's these events that really lead the Cuban government to attempt to protect small Cuban producers by limiting sugar production on the island in order to help try to lift global prices. But Lobo disagreed with this policy, believing that it would only encourage other producers to expand the amount they produced, increase the quality, and increase performance of sugar mill equipment, and improve efficiency throughout the entire system. In fact, throughout his career, Lobo would use his influence to try to protect Cuban sugar producers and curtail the influence of U.S. investors. Lobo, famous for using the amount of sugar he controlled to influence the markets, would stockpile vast quantities of refined sugar in order to release onto the markets in one huge push. Lobo was a master of manipulating the markets and would use all of this to his advantage in order to force his prices onto U.S.-controlled companies that would produce items such as soft drinks, candies, and a wide range of other products. While he did exercise a large amount of power, Lobo considered himself first and foremost a businessman, and primarily tried to keep himself out of all of the politics and backhand dealings of the Cuban government. This had served him and his family well over the years, and had limited the number of political entanglements experienced by the Lobo family. But with the rise of Batista and the growing number of laws and regulations limiting the sugar production of the island, Lobo and many other sugar producers would start to see the effect that an uncooperative government can have on agricultural economics. Lobo, having attended LSU and learned the newest and most advanced techniques for sugar production, desired to bring in new machinery for harvest as well as crushing the cane and refining the sugar juice. But unfortunately, due to the regulations and restrictions put in by Batista, he would be unable to import large amounts of the equipment and machinery from the United States. In fact, a number of experimental harvesters were withheld at the ports of Havana and never released, eventually sent back to the United States in New Orleans. Lobo, unwilling to use his financial influence to steer the political direction of the country, would instead use that money to help improve living conditions in the communities around his mills. Lobo, well liked by many of his employees, even on a first-name basis with almost everyone under his influence, not only improving the quality of the mills where he could, the roadways, docks, railways, and all the equipment around the facilities that would help make for better profit margins as well as increased productivity. But Lobo would also spend a large amount of money building new churches, clinics, schools, and sponsoring a number of students to go on to colleges across the country. As Batista's reign continued, the country of Cuba would begin to descend into organized chaos. Mob rule, violence, shootings. Havana, a dangerous place to be in the 1950s. A wide variety of people across the island would desire change. What change, what form it would take, and how it would affect the lives of everyone on the island, many were not overly concerned with. In fact, most people on the island before Castro seemed to be content with not Batista being an answer to who should rule Cuba. Many small rebel groups formed throughout the island, especially in the eastern provinces of Cuba. Many of the rebel groups, including those underneath Fidel Castro in the July 26th movement, would threaten many sugar producers and require them to pay in order to prevent their fields from being burned. In fact, many sugar producers of the time are willing to pay these fees and see them as of the price of doing business. A number of others even go far as to support the rebels further and further in their endeavors. Lobo himself is one of the former. It was generally seen as better for business to pay off the rebels and keep production moving. A field burned to the ground is an entire season's worth of work lost. And in Lobo's mind, not only is he losing money on the lack of production, but he is unable to pay workers in the fields, so more people suffer. By the end of 1958, the small rebels are no longer just in the mountains, and Fidel Castro has begun his march across the Cuban island. After Batista flees the island on January 1st of 1959, Castro and his rebels would make their way across the island to Havana, reaching the capital on January 8th. Many Cubans on the island, including Lobo, saw this as a good thing. New leadership, a new government, new regulations, and maybe a little more freedom on the island. Unfortunately for businessmen and capitalists like Lobo, the future was not as bright as they seemed to hope at the time. Without knowing that at the time, though, Lobo would continue to work with the new government, even as they began to move towards more socialistic policies and eventually into communism. Even into the summer of 1960, Lobo would continue to sell and promote Cuban sugar. In light of a new rising government without U.S. influence, U.S. sugar purchasers would begin holding back in order to hopefully weaken the new Cuban government. Lobo would order agents in both New York and London to begin purchasing sugar futures. A move Lobo had pulled numerous times before sharply increased the price of sugar on the global markets. With steeply rising prices, many other sugar producers would withhold large amounts of sugar in order to see if they could make a larger profit with the rising sugar price. This is when Lobo's experience trading sugar and commodities would come to shine. He quickly books all of the space on charter ships able to carry sugar to and from the United States. Lobo, now in a position to control most of the sugar coming in and out of the United States, would wait for the price to rise. And rise the price did. U.S. sugar consumers would withhold purchasing from the island of Cuba for as long as they could. But day by day, the price would climb. And at 5.4 cents per pound, Pepsi Cola would be the first to buy from Lobo. They would buy again almost 24 hours later, this time at 5.7 cents per pound, and others would begin to follow suit. Within the next couple weeks, Lobo would push the price up by almost half, to almost 7.58 cents per pound. For the new revolutionary government of Cuba, this was a major boon. Large amounts of income coming into the state, all stemming from that one main agricultural product in Cuba, sugar. The revolutionary government kindly ignored the fact that this was capitalism fighting capitalism, and Lobo, one of the best, would have been the top candidate in order to continue utilizing and protecting Cuban sugar. But even if he was given the special privilege of being saved to last, the Cuban revolutionary government would come for Lobo. In October of 1960, Lobo would finally go to meet with Che Guevara, the then head of the central bank of the new revolutionary government. Guevara certainly loved being the central banker and would always make a rather large deal of how he had acquired the job, claiming that Castro had asked for an economist, and having raised his hand, Castro would ask Che, I did not know you were an economist. Shay laughingly replied back, I thought you said you needed a good communist. Not a long list of qualifications, but one that Castro would deem long enough. Lobo and Guerrero's meeting that October was described as fairly cordial, meeting in a fairly amicable basis. Guerrero supposedly even comments on Lobo's finances, claiming to have not found a stain or a blemish on any of Lobo's accounts. It is during these conversations, though, that Lobo realizes this is the end. The future Cuba that Lobo had envisioned was to be no more. It's shortly after this meeting that Lobo, like many others, would flee the island of Cuba. Lobo would spend most of the rest of his days in Spain, outside of Madrid. Lobo would pass away in Madrid on January 30th, 1983, and he would be buried in Alamunda Cathedral in Madrid. There, surrounded by princes and princesses of the royal family, Lobo would find a fitting place to rest as the Sugar King of Havana. Lobo's experiences of the Cuban Revolution, while unique and interesting, in a way mirror many of those experienced by islanders. But Cuba remains, today, an island in the glistening waters of the Caribbean. Leaders have changed, people come and gone, but the island remains. The topic of change on Cuba tends to be a tricky one to discuss. Many things change throughout the years, while many strangely say very much the same. Cuba's economy would remain primarily dependent on sugar production even after the collapse of their relations with the United States. Other partners, like the Soviet Union and Venezuela, would come along and pick up the slack, but the ever-present specter of monoculture would continue to loom over the island of Cuba. Cuba's reliance on sugar has continued to be a problem, and the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 80s and early 90s would show this once again. Since then, Cuba has made moves to modernize their economy and has begun to move into a modern tourist island culture. While this may seem like a good move, it might perhaps be seen more as a sidestep into the monoculture of modern economies, tourism. This problem exists not only in Cuba, but all over the modern world, including the United States. Many areas have become so dependent on tourism for their economies that everything else seems to suffer and become secondary. I think the big lesson we can kind of take from all of this is that protecting what always has been or what is commonly held up or protected something may no longer be in our best interest to do so. Change isn't a bad thing. And whether we like it or not, the modern world that we live in is demanding more and more change every day. So that is kind of the end of what I was hoping to discuss on our first podcast today. I guess I'm going to cut it a little short as opposed to going the full hour rather than rambling and driving you guys crazy. But before we go, I would like to give, a reading suggestion. I don't have any way to list a whole lot of sources. Maybe I'll find a way to put some of that on the website. But if you are interested, I have a little suggestion. The Sugar King of Havana by John Paul Rathbone. This was one of the heavier used sources in today's podcast, especially if you're interested in Julio Lobo, the figure. He also goes into some of his family history. Excellent reads, very entertaining. So go out and take a look. But I hope you guys have enjoyed, and I'd love to hear any feedback from you. The easiest way to contact us is to either go to our website at www.hammockhistorian.com or send us an email at hammockhistorian@gmail.com. So thank you guys, and I hope you've enjoyed. We'll see you on the next episode.